I've managed to get out of pretty much everything today, even down to making my son take my place and lead this morning. But the one thing I couldn't get out of was speaking tonight. I did think that perhaps Rob might like to step in and take over. That would be absolutely fine. But actually, I'm feeling a lot better now than I was earlier, and I'm certainly a lot better today than I was yesterday. John gave me the title, God Dwelling Amongst Us. And then he gave me the whole of John chapter 1. So to quote the angels in the Christmas carol, fear not. I am really not going to try and speak on the whole of John chapter 1. I promise I will confine myself to John's prologue. So really, I'm going to focus on the first 14 verses. So let me just read those to you before I go any further. If you've got a Bible or you want to get up on your phone, it's just literally the first chapter of John. If you want to put a finger somewhere else, which will be useful because we'll be darting around a bit, the other place to have a finger is Genesis chapter 1, because it seems to me the two go kind of hand in hand. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. There came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world didn't recognize him. He came to that which were his own, but his own didn't receive him. Yet to all that received him, to those that believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling amongst us. We've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. And what I want to do is just pick up some of the themes that come out of this passage, really. And I think probably throw around some ideas and possibly some questions. And it may be that you will go away with more questions than answers tonight. The more I look at this passage, even as we were praying before we came out, I kind of came away with one of those kind of God moments. If that's that, that must mean this. I can't get my head around that. And it's kind of one of those passages. I spent a lot of time in John's Gospel last term. We kind of ran a bit of an experimental course for people that wanted to know more about Jesus, called basically Seven Signs of John, or Face to Face with Jesus. And it was looking at the miracles in John's Gospel. There are seven that are recorded, and John calls them very specifically signs because they show us something about Jesus. And at the end of his gospel, he says that, you know, there are many, many other things that could have been recorded, but the things he did record, particularly those signs, were recorded that people might know that Jesus was the Christ, and that they might believe in him, and that they might find life through him. And so kind of there's a real kind of clear structure to what John is about in his gospel. And it is completely different to what takes place in the other gospels, which we often call the synoptic gospels, because they have kind of the same structure and the same pattern. If I'm honest, on the whole, I'm more at home in the synoptics, in Matthew, Mark and Luke. And I think that's because I like a good story. And essentially, they're a narrative. You know, they tell us the story of Jesus' life. They start at the beginning and they end at the end, and they make their way through it. And there's an element of that in John's Gospel. But actually, rather than trying to, in a sense, give us the history of Jesus, what John does is decides the things he wants us to know about Jesus, and he chooses the specific incidents that kind of make that clear, and he kind of includes Jesus' teaching about those things around those areas. So what he does is much more topical. What the others do are is much more about narrative. And we get a bit of that in the prologue. Because when Matthew and Luke introduce Jesus, they introduce him as a baby. They kind of talk about him being born. It's kind of a story we can get our heads around. That's what we've been thinking about pretty much all of this Christmas period. When Matthew and Luke try to help us understand who Jesus is, they kind of draw attention to the names that he's given, that he's Emmanuel, that he's God with us, that he's Jesus, which means he's come, that God's come to save us, that God saves, that he's the Christ, that he's the Messiah. And kind of, so when, you know, we're introduced to Jesus, that's the way they help us to understand what it means for God to come in human form. It's very picture language. It's easy for us to get our heads round. John really doesn't do it that way. John kind of does it in kind of, I guess, put it in a more intellectual, in a deeper way, from a completely different kind of standpoint. Rather than pointing to a baby, Jesus is introduced to us as the Logos or the Word. And so we start here. In the beginning was the Word. And this is John introducing Jesus coming into the world to us. Now, the Word comes from the Greek Logos. It's not just about a spoken word. It's about kind of the whole process of thought that becomes word. So it, as well as having the idea of a word that is spoken and is understood, it also has the idea of kind of what is thought. It's the word logos also has the idea of reason, that you kind of think something and understand it. So it's kind of the thought word. Jews and Greeks would have understood Logos in radically different ways. For a Jew, Logos would have been synonymous with God, with describing God. But for a Greek, it would have been much more philosophical. It would have been about the rational principles that govern our world. What gives our world order would flow out of Logos. Kind of thought process that becomes reality, that orders the world in which we live. This is big picture stuff in trying to make sense of who Jesus is. I want to unpack that a little bit and just pick out some of the key themes that come out of it. So, to begin with, in the beginning, John's prologue introduces, you know, the story of our recreation, our being made spiritually alive and new. And kind of everything he says in his prologue is almost like it echoes the story of creation. So for him, recreation and creation are completely connected. In Genesis, and this is where kind of the fingers become necessary, and I'm not going to be as adept as probably I should be. We read, in the beginning, God. And in John, we read, in the beginning was the Word. John's prologue echoes Genesis. And the same things come out of it. In Genesis, it begins with God. In John, it begins with the Word. This whole idea that there's nothing before God, that creation is out of nothing, is there in both of them. It's kind of the phrase that's used is creation is ex nihilo, the belief that God created the world out of nothing. In Genesis, in the beginning, it was God. In John, in the beginning was the Word. And that's where John begins his account of recreation and restoration. And he echoes the language of Genesis. And it's like with the coming of Jesus, so much that in the past that's been hidden is now revealed. You'll be familiar with this whole way kind of Paul talks about the idea of mystery and of things that are secret and things that are hidden, and that people trying to understand them in the past, but them only coming to light with the coming of Jesus. And this is one of those occasions. Because up until this point, kind of monotheistic has meant one God, God Almighty. Here suddenly, John is already taking us deeper and saying that that God that is one is also three persons. And he's introducing the second person of the Trinity to us and saying that just as there was God in the beginning, there was always Jesus in the beginning. The Word was with God in the beginning, and the Word was God. Have you ever had conversations on the doorstep with Jehovah's Witnesses? Anyone kind of get sucked into those conversations? Anyone want to admit to that one? Do you find yourself bamboozled by them? I can remember one of the occasions when I had a conversation about them. And the whole issue with Jehovah's Witnesses, well, there's two issues, really. I guess the first one is about who is Jesus. You know, is Jesus God or not? And the second one is, you know, actually, what does our salvation rest upon? Does it rest just upon what Jesus did on the cross? Or does it rest upon our action, somehow doing enough to save ourselves on top? And they are big dividing lines. And actually, frequently, they're the dividing lines between Orthodox Christianity and heresy right through the ages. And probably the clearest cut one today is with Jehovah's Witnesses. But I can remember on the doorstep kind of pointing to John and saying, you know, it's quite clear when John talks about the Word, he's talking about Jesus and he's saying the Word was with God and the Word was God. And they kind of say, oh no, but I mean, actually in the Greek it says that he was a God. There is no A in the Greek. You know, he was God is the meaning of the Greek. For John, it's utterly clear that the one that has become human flesh, that he lives his life with as a disciple of Jesus, is God taking our flesh and living amongst us. Not just God coming, a part of God coming into being, but God that has always pre-existed and always been three persons. And so there's this kind of sense of, with the coming of Jesus, what was hidden, but always was, that God was Trinity, is being made clear. The next thing to kind of focus on is actually creation itself, making things, being created, and also, dare I say it, being creative, because we are made in the image of God, and we echo and we reflect the character of God. And so John goes on, through him all things were made that have been made. And I remember years ago going to Spring Harvest and hearing, you know how someone says something once and you kind of sticks in your brain and it completely changes your thought pattern forever. I remember a throwaway line from Gerald Coates, and I don't know whether it was the point of his sermon or not, and it hit me then like a 10-ton bus, and it's never left me. When he said, you know, it says in creation that God spoke. And again, if we put our finger back into Genesis, yeah, and we read just that opening verse, in the beginning was God. Well, John says in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God and was God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And then God spoke. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And the Word Gerald Coates said, that was spoken was Christ. God spoke, and the word, the doulos of God, was God's activity. And it's that whole thing about kind of, thought and rational word that's in our head that becomes spoken and has a creative force. And it's like part of the way that the Trinity seems to work in creation is that that the conception of God is spoken forth, and that becomes the Word of God. And the Word is Jesus, the active agent of God in creation. And that's what John is saying is happening here. Through him, through the Word, all things have been made. And God spoke. The Logos, the very Word of God, was spoken and brings the universe into existence. Very grateful to Helen Stephen for one of my Christmas presents this year. I don't know if anyone's been reading Michael Gunger's book on creativity, The Crowd, The Critic and The Muse. I'm very pleased that she's given it to me because Claire's been reading it in the office and she keeps coming and saying, you've got to read this, it's so good, it's so good. So now I'm actually getting a chance to read it. It is brilliant. Don't switch off if you think, oh, but I'm not creative. It's kind of for everyone. And he makes the point that everyone is creative. And there's some just things that kind of he says about creativity that I think pick up on this whole idea of God's activity in creation through Jesus, the Word, but also what it means for us to be made in the image of God and to reflect that too. And if you're about to switch off, actually Gunga argues that we're all creative. I love his definition of creativity. He describes it as an intentional ordering of reality. Now stick that alongside that whole idea of logos being word, being both reason and thought. The idea is on the whole that we think before we speak. I know that you think that I don't do that as often as I should do. But that's how it's meant to work. You know, thought is conceived and it flows out as intentional speech. In the same way as we have an idea and we make something. That's what we see happening in creation, isn't it? That's what God does as he speaks the word that is the logos, that is Jesus, and brings creation, brings intentional order into being that shapes chaos into substance. And actually, because we're made in the image of God, that's also what we are designed to do. And so for Gunga, his comment is that actually the industrialist, the person that conceives of a petrochemical plant, who would say, oh, they're the scientist or they're the engineer, is just as creative as the person that gets their paints out and paints the Mona Lisa. Because it's conceiving something and then bringing it forth in an intentional way. And that's the character and the nature of God. And we're made in God's image. So that's what we're designed to be like. So actually this whole thing about this distinction we make between kind of those of us that would say, oh, we're creative, and those who say, oh, I'm just kind of a practical sort. Actually, it's kind of, because we're made in the image of God, you can't not be creative because God is the creator God. That's how he is. And that's how we are because we're made in his image too. And if we kind of stick with this whole thing about the word and reason and speech, again, just to quote Gunga, every sentence you've ever articulated has been a creative work on some level. Now, that actually is a fairly frightening thought, because actually it just underlines the way our words have power to either build and be positive or to undermine or to destroy. And actually, kind of, if you contrast Jesus and Satan, actually, Jesus' words, he isn't just the word, but his words consistently speak life. Whereas whenever you find the devil at work in the scriptures, his name means the accuser. His very name means someone that accuses, and his words continually undermine. And it just begs the question, our words are created. They will achieve what is conceived in our mind that they should conceive. But do they build up? Do they heal? Do they bring life? Or do they pull down and undermine and destroy? So I'm throwing thoughts out there. I'm not necessarily giving you answers. And then we kind of move from this whole thing of creation to the process of it. Again, let's just jump back and just read that verse in Genesis again. In the beginning was God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And God spoke, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. God spoke, logos, and there was light. In creation, God is intentionally ordering reality, to quote Gunga. Its sources in his mind, reason, logos, its expression is through word. He speaks and it comes into being. And we're made in his image. And that creativity is built into us just as it is in his own nature. But it's marred. And John tells us that the words become flesh. That very word God spoke, his own character, his own nature, has come and made his dwelling amongst us. And that's why John can talk about seeing his glory, the glory of the one and only who comes from the Father, who's full of truth, grace and truth. Now, God speaks, and the first part of creation is there's light. And so we read on, "Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it." Now, it's taken me most of my life to realise that actually I have a creative side. And for me, a lot of that is expressed through photography. Although, actually, the more I start reading Michael Gunga, the more I think, well, actually, part of my creativity, and you might wish I didn't express it quite so much, actually is expressed by what I'm doing now, if that makes sense. That's part of, and I would have made a distinction from that to what I do when I do something photographically, when I try and conceive of an image and try and make it happen. And because of the photography, I found myself, because I kind of relate what I do, creatively to my faith, I found myself coming back again and again to this verse about in him was life, and that life was the light of men. And actually, one of my best kept secrets, because it's not exactly followed by very many people, I actually have one blog, but I still up and I blog, but actually I don't seem to have followers, which is rather sad. You can go, and you can pat me on the back afterwards if you're sorry for me. But actually I gave the name to the blog, Light and Life, because this is a whole combination of how the two come together photographically. Light is what we need to make photographs. Photography is writing or drawing with light, but actually it's somehow an expression of life. And I found myself thinking about these verses quite a lot. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. And then in Genesis, and God spoke and said, let there be light, and there was light. One of the most popular things we do at Christmas here is the Christingle service. If you've not got children, you'll have missed it. If you have children, as Kevin does, he would tell you it is a marvellous experience. There's nothing like the smell of your children's hair burning. It brings a whole new meaning to Christmas. No, actually, it's really nice. But it's more than just a sentimental kind of service for children. It actually originated with the Moravians. How much do I need to say about this? Who kind of can say, I know something about the Moravians? Anyone know anything about the Moravians? Okay, this is where talks get longer. The Moravians... you don't want the whole of my sabbatical's research on Moravians to come out now. Okay. They were a community of people that lived kind of in Germany on the kind of German-Polish Czechoslovakia kind of border area, what would be called Moravia at the time. They were led by a guy called Count Zinzendorf, and they established the most incredible missionary movement that, although you may know little about them, actually kind of changed the known world at the time. They were responsible for taking the gospel to America, to the slave colonies in the West Indies, all sorts of places where no one had taken the gospel before. They were the way they impacted us is secondhand. Wesley went as a missionary and as a non-Christian to America to preach, and had a massive crisis of faith. And he encountered Moravians on the way there, and they were responsible for turning John Wesley's life around and kind of being the Methodism kind of came out of, and what kind of started afar right across England in terms of the evangelical revival of the kind of 1800s, 1700s even. That's kind of potted history of the significance of the Moravians. So Christingle actually began with them and with Count Zinzendorf. We go with the whole orange thing, and it all kind of gets complicated with lots of sweets because the kids like it, and it all gets given extra bits of meaning. For them, it was much simpler. It was just a candle with a red ribbon tied around it. And it was first celebrated in Marienborn in Germany in 1747. And for them, it was all about this whole idea of what we're thinking about now, about the Word becoming flesh and coming into our world as the light of the world. I guess the Moravians were pietistic. They were people that were kind of focused on God capturing their heart about being passionate for him and wanting to be set on fire for him. And so for them, the emphasis was very much on how that flame, that light coming into the world, has kindled a flame in their hearts. And that was what that candle was to symbolize, the light coming into the world and lighting up their lives with the presence and the reality of God. Now, when I think about the passage here, I often kind of think, well, hang on, John, you've got it the wrong way around. You've talked about Jesus being life and that life being the light of men. Surely it should be Jesus is light and that light being the life of man, because scientifically you need, I'm no great scientist, this will be patently obvious, but actually for life to exist, you need light, don't you? It's almost like it's in reverse. You need light first and life follows it. But actually John puts it the other way round. It's life first, and the life becomes the source of the light. And it's interesting, because in creation, we can also think it's the wrong way round too. It begins with talking in verse 3 and 4 about God creating light on the first day. And actually, the sun and the moon and the stars, which are the source of light, only come in on day, whatever it is, someone can remind me later on. It's almost like it's the wrong way around. And actually, the reason for that is that actually creation is telling us, even though we can't see it then, and John is certainly telling us, that actually the light that comes into the world, the light that's there, just as the creative force of God is his word, which is Jesus, so the light is also the creative force of God. And actually the light flows from Jesus before there's ever a star or a sun or a moon created. And so I just thought we would do something visual tonight. I am winding down. I'm going to finish with a bit of heresy. But before I get to the heresy, let's just kind of go back to Count Zinzendorf. And I just kind of thought it would be great for us to take away from here, even if you kind of go, what on earth was the vicar on about tonight? Light. So there's candles at the front. At the end, when we have a final song, if you want to come and take one of those candles and take it with you to your home, back into the darkness tonight, as a response to Jesus as the light of the world coming into our lives, I'd encourage you to do that. What I would just say is use some common sense, health and safety wise. If you're driving home, blow it out first. I'm sure that you would think to do that, but perhaps I'm doubting the brains of some of you. Sorry. No reference to anyone in particular, Daniel. No. The final thing, and I'll shut up, and it's more of a question than an answer. Again, it's an art and a creative word. It's chiaroscura. It means literally light, dark. It's Italian for light, dark. It's one of those things that kind of fascinates me photographically, because I kind of like dark images. I like images with great contrast between light and dark. And John goes on to say, the light that shines in the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. And it just leaves me with a sense of mystery about that. Because as Christians, we like to be really black and white about things sometimes. And I found myself wondering, is darkness always evil? Certainly, it's represented as evil. You know, I've already talked about taking light out into the darkness of the night. We might look around our world and we might say that it feels at times to be a very dark place. Even in this Christmas season, you know, I mean, those of you who are here for the carousels will know that I poured a bucket of cold water over everyone by talking about the murder of the children in Peshawar. It does feel at times like our world is a very, very dark place. But is darkness always wrong? What would the world be like with no darkness? And actually, as a photographer, I can tell you, with no darkness, you would have nothing. You can't make a picture without there being some graduation between light and dark. And it seems to me there was always darkness. There was darkness before the fall. We read in Genesis about Jesus saying, God saying, let there be light, and the light comes, but there is still darkness. And at that point, there's no sense that is evil. And it seems to me we look at the things that happen in our world, and we want to try and treat everything that is negative as wrong, and we would all choose to walk, you know, to lead our lives and to walk through life kind of with some sort of super Christian charm on us, that nothing would affect us that is uncomfortable or difficult or whatever. And actually, I think there's a challenge to us in this whole sense of light coming into the world. Because somehow we're called to live with light and darkness. There's a choice about how we respond to light. And kind of that's unpacked if we kind of read through the prologue. Kind of it goes into this whole thing about him coming to his own, coming to the Jewish people and then rejecting him. There's a choice about accepting and rejecting Jesus. But there's also a sense that we seem to live with this tension between light and dark. And I think there's somehow within it a warning for me against kind of an over-triumphalism that we find in Christianity at times, that that everyone is going to be healed, that everything is going to be made, and the black and whiteness about whether people are good or bad. Actually, there is light in the darkest place, and there is darkness in the lightest place. Without both, we wouldn't be able to perceive it or see it or make sense of it. I think that's the heresy over for the evening. Let's pray. Lord, there's so much in these verses that I find it really hard to get my head around. I find it hard to grasp what it means for you to truly be the Word. That your reason is articulated in this world in which we live. It's articulated through Jesus, articulated through your action, articulated through our lives. And you call us to mirror that. You've made us in your image. That same creative impulse is there within every one of us. That you're light, and that the darkness doesn't understand you, and yet it's still there. And at times we recoil from the darkness, but perhaps at times we should also embrace it. To see your reason in the dark as well as in the light. Lord, if ever there was a time when we find ourselves thinking that your ways are higher than our ways, that we don't understand, for me this is one of those times. We live 2,000 years after the Word becoming flesh and living amongst us. There's still darkness in the world, and your light still shines in the world. And you want it shines in our lives, and you want it to shine through our lives.